You are now listening to Jess is Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Jess is Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare Sonnets. I've been getting a lot of good comments and feedback lately about this Shakespeare series that I'm doing, and so I'm super happy about it because I really enjoy reading Shakespeare in general. And I'm also very much liking the fact that all of you guys who are listening are finding joy and value in this. And so I just like to thank all of you guys for enjoying the series. But of course, if you guys do have any other recommendations in regards to certain poets or literature stuff or ideas that you have in mind that you want me to go over, just feel free to shoot me a text or anything just to let me know, and I'd be happy to go over it. But today we will start Sonnet 31, and I'm hoping to get through to Sonnet 35. Yeah, I'm hoping to finish off Sonnet 35. And so that will be it for today. I do have two songs in mind, which I will play one right now, with some ads, show promos, and PSAs, of course. And then the other one just sometime in the middle or towards the end of the episode. That's kind of how we're going to do it today. I hope everyone's doing well. It's been a while since I've actually done a show very late on campus. It's 8 o'clock right now, currently in Vancouver, BC, Canada. And got to tell you, it's a cool vibe, a different vibe. It was super nice outside until the rain kind of returned just a couple minutes ago. I'm glad I just had my umbrella laying around in my bag because the rain is falling down quite heavy right now, which is crazy. But what can you say? We live in Vancouver. But other than that, yeah, I will play my first song called Portia. It's called Think of Me by Portia White. I remember playing the song in my previous episodes, but it's always nice to bring some old songs back. So Think on Me by Portia White will play, and then right after we'll have some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and then we will get right into the readings. So we'll be right back after this, Think on Me by Portia White.
By all thine eyes have told me.
take a moment to ease your mind. I'm glad you're here. Have you been to that sacred place within? That place that sound can create? Let's go there together. A place with the freshest beats. Gamelan tones of Indonesia. The many sounds of Brazil. The possibilities are infinite. All available on Mixotroph, the best in world music, every other Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Join me, Nolzy, for exclusive interviews with local musicians and musical explorations. Tune in!
Storytelling is powerful. Our stories carry personal and collective histories, build bridges of understanding, and shine light on unseen truths. Your story, your voice, your power. CITR and Discorder is excited to announce the release of 5 unique podcasts as a part of its Power and Voice podcast incubation program. Power and Voice is an entry-level educational program created by CITR to surpass traditional barriers to entry into the medium of spoken word radio and podcasting. The result is a series of podcasts demonstrating a wide diversity of work in genre, structure, and content. Tune in every day from April 14th to 18th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. to hear Power and Voice storytellers share their stories on their own terms and in their own words.
DOXA, Western Canada's largest documentary film festival, returns to present the 24th edition from May 1st to the 11th. DOXA will screen a roster of timely and thought-provoking documentaries in theatrical venues across the city, bringing filmmakers and audiences together for an engaging cinema experience. The 2025 lineup showcases 39 features, 30 short and mid-length films, and industry events. Screenings will take place at the Vancouver Playhouse, the Cinematheque, VIF Center, and SFU Goldcore Center for the Arts. Head to doxa.ca to grab your tickets and explore all that DOXA has to offer this May. The Vancouver Cherry Blossom Festival is running its most vibrant season yet, until April 28th, 2025. This year, the festival offers an even larger and more diverse lineup of events that celebrate both the beauty of the cherry blossoms and the richness of our community and local art scene. There's something for everyone to enjoy, with many of these events being free to the public. A cultural celebration with traditional performances, arts and culture, and delicious Japanese cuisine, created in collaboration with Japan Fair Association of Vancouver. Other supporting events include haiku invitational, workshops, tree talks and walks, and much more. The Vancouver Cherry Blossom Festival invites attendees to celebrate Vancouver's cherry tree heritage through accessible arts, culture, and nature programming in the city's parks and neighborhoods.
Welcome back to Jess is Lit. Those were some ads, show promos and PSAs, and Think on Me by Portia White. Now we'll get right into the readings. We'll start off with Sonnet 31. Thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead. And there reigns love in all lovers' loving parts, and all those friends which I thought buried. How many a holy and obsequious tear hath dear religious love stolen from mine eye, as interest of the dead which now appear, but things removed that hidden in thee lie. Thou art the grave where buried love doth live, hung with the trophies of my lovers gone, who all their parts of me to thee did give, that due of many now is thine alone. Their images I love I view in thee, and thou all they hast all the all of me. So here this poem kind of sees the, I guess the poet sees the many friends now lost to him as contained in his beloved. And so therefore, the love he once gave to his lost friends is now given wholly to the beloved. And so lines 1 and 2, thy bosom is endeared with all hearts, which I by lacking have supposed dead. Here the speaker addresses a beloved thou and claims that all the hearts he once cherished but thought lost now live within his this one person's heart. And so the word bosom suggests that both the emotional and physical seat of affection. Endeared with all hearts implies that the beloved contains or is beloved by all others. And the speaker is contained or beloved by all others the speaker once cared for. And so here's a bit of the significance here. This kind of sets up a tone of reclamation. And so where love thought lost has been recovered or reconstituted. And so that was lines 1 and 2. Lines 3 and 4. And there reigns love in all love's loving parts and all those friends which I thought buried. And so we can see here that the beloved's heart becomes a sort of kingdom where love reigns. With it, all of the elements of love, quote-unquote love's loving parts, which includes affection, intimacy, loyalty, they all become related to how love reigns. Lines 5 and 6, how many a holy and obsequious tear hath dear religious love stolen from mine eye. Now this couplet gives us a more, gives us a more mournful, devotional image, I would say. And the speaker reflects on the many holy and obsequious, which is implied dutiful and reverent, tears he has shed. And so the quote-unquote dear religious love will suggest a kind of sacred mourning where the act of grieving itself becomes, in a sense, devotional. And stolen from mine eye is a personification, and so it personifies love as a thief, gently stealing tears, which is a subtle image of I guess, love causing involuntary emotion. And so that's that. Lines 7 and 8, as interest of the dead which now appear, but things removed that hidden in thee lie. Now here, the tears are like interest paid, financially, it's a financial term, interest. And so the tears are like interest paid on the memory of the dead. So it's basically a kind of emotional debt. And so now those dead loves are not truly gone. They're just merely things that are removed, quote unquote, things removed, not annihilated, but just recollected. Relocated. And so the line's final image here is significant, where it implies or conveys that the beloved becomes a container or a tomb in which all these former affections now lie hidden. And so I guess we could kind of think about that and think about the significance there. Where it kind of picks up on the idea of resurrection again through memory or emotional projection. And so we could see that the speaker sees the beloved as holding within them everything he thought was lost or he thought had lost. Lines 9 to 10, Thou art the grave where buried love doth live, hung with the trophies of my lovers gone. Now we are provided with a paradox here. The beloved is both grave and life. And so what the beloved is compared to a tomb, where a tomb, it's a tomb where both love lives on. So there's a bit of a paradox with death and love there. Quote unquote, hung with the trophies will suggest commemoration, like a shrine to the speaker's past loves. And there's also possibly a reference to military trophies implying conquest or glory, which in a sense gives the beloved a kind of victorious aura, I should say. And so this interplay, this fusion of death and vitality is, I think, very Shakespearean. We could see a lot of we could see a lot of plays and poems from Shakespeare that deal with the both opposites of love and death and life and death in general. And so, lines 11, 12. Who all their parts of me in thee did give, that due of many now is thine alone. This is a moment of emotional summation. All the speaker's past lovers gave parts of him to those relationships, but now all those fragments have been transferred to this one person alone. And so the phrase due of many, which is the emotional debt once owed to many, is now owed to one. Moving on to lines 13, 14, the final couplet. Their images I love, I view in thee, and thou all they hast all the all of me. Now here the speaker sees in the beloved the images of all those he once loved, like reflections or ghosts. And so the final line is, I think, very powerful because the beloved is not just like the others, but he literally is them. And this is seen in the phrase all they. And the phrase all the all of me, I believe, emphasizes totality, where the speaker gives himself entirely, and it that suggests that through this one love, all his emotional past is we could say both gathered and transcended. And so that's kind of how the poem ends. And so very interesting, deep poem there, Sonnet 31. We'll move on to Sonnet 32. If thou survive my well-contented day, when that churl death my bones will dust shall cover, and shalt by fortune once more resurvey those poor rude lines of thy deceased lover, compare them with the bet-ring of the time, and though they be outstripped by every pen, reserve them for my love, not for their rhyme. Exceeded by the height of happier men, oh, then vouchsafe me but this loving thought. Had my friend's muse grown with this growing age, a dearer birth than this his love has brought, to march in ranks of better equipage. But since he died, and poets better prove, theirs for their style I will read, for his for his love. That was Sonnet 32. We could see that the poet here imagines his poems being read and judged by his beloved after the poet's death, and he asks that the poems, although not as excellent as those written by later writers, be kept and enjoyed because of the love expressed in them. So that's kind of, I think, what this means. We'll give this one a deeper read in lines 1 to 4. So the speaker imagines their own death in the phrase well-counted, contended day, suggesting peace or fulfillment in dying, possibly from a life well-lived. We also see that death is personified as a churl, the phrase churl, a rude or ill-bred man, which emphasizes the harshness and inevitability. By fortune, the phrase by fortune will imply chance or fate, where if the beloved happens upon these poems again after the speaker's death. And so there's a bit of a tension between love and art here. So the poet worries about being remembered, but not through poetry, rather through the memory of love. So that's kind of significant there. Lines 5 to 8. In lines 5 to 8, he expects that the poetic standards will improve in the phrase bettering of the time, and future poets will write with greater skill. And the poet seems to also fear being, quote-unquote, outstripped by every pen, surpassed in technique and eloquence. But still, he asks the beloved to, quote-unquote, reserve them, which means to keep them for the sake of love, not literary merit. And so here we see the emphasis of love. The phrase, the height of happier men, I think implies that poets are more fortunate, talented, or simply alive longer. And so the word happier in this sense could also suggest those with greater external success, contrasting with the speaker's more personal emotional depth. And so we could see that the speaker is self-effacing, but also suggesting a unique value in his authentic emotional connection, which is something here in this context, something deeper than polished, than a well-rounded verse. And so that's significant here. Lines 9 to 12, this is when he asks for one loving thought. And so it's kind of an imaginative grace. So I would say a question that arises here is what if he had lived longer? And so then his muse might have been matured too. And so the phrase, the word muse, in a sense, is poetic inspiration. And so he imagines that his art could have kept pace with the era's evolution, where the phrase, this growing age, is relevant here. A dearer birth. The phrase, a dearer birth, which is a better poem, might have been born from that matured muse. And march in ranks of better equipage is more of a military metaphor, where it kind of implies that poetry as a kind of parade, with the current work lacking the armor or refinement, which is interpreted for equipage of the later poets. And so we could see here that he's not just concerned with art, but with how art ages and how love might preserve value even as aesthetic standards shift. And so here again, the emphasis on the importance of love and the powerfulness of love. The final couplet is where the volta appears. And so the speaker imagines that the beloved separating style from substance. So we get the context here with style and substance, the diverging of style from substance. And so the phrase poets better prove, which is that they're more accomplished now, he concedes to that. And so we could see that the final couplet here is a quiet plea for emotional immortality. And so that's significant there. Moving on to Sonnet 33, we'll give this one a read. Full many a glorious morning have I seen, flatter the mountaintops with sovereign eye, kissing with golden face the meadows green, gliding, gilding pale streams with heavenly alchemy. Anon, permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly rack on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace. Even so my sun one early morn did shine with all triumphant splendor on my brow. But, out alack, he was but 1 hour mine. The region cloud hath masked him from me now. Yet him for this my love no whit disdaineth. Suns of the world may stain when heaven's sun staineth. Now here, we see that the poet describes the sun first in its glory, and then after, it's being covered with dark clouds. And so this change resembles his relationship with the beloved, who is now masked from him. But even if the sun could be darkened, he writes, it's no wonder that earthly beings sometimes fail to remain bright and unstained. And so this is the first of, I believe, more, where the beloved is in a sense pictured as having hurt the poet through some unspecified deed, some unspecified misdeed. And so we get a kind of a new thing going on here. Lines 1-4. So then Shakespeare begins. He begins with a more radiant image of sunrise, and he personifies the sun as a majestic sovereign with a quote-unquote sovereign eye, which flatters the mountains, kissing meadows, and transforming the pale streams with quote-unquote heavenly alchemy. And so, very interesting diction here. And so the diction, glorious, sovereign, golden, heavenly, etc., will invoke awe and admiration. And so we see a sensual beauty in the verbs flatter, kissing, gilding, very intimate, tender acts we see. And so we could see that the stanza here suggests a sense of admiration for something or someone once perceived as awe-inspiring and beautiful. And so a kind of idealized love or presence. Moving on to lines 5 and 8. Now we kind of turn into we turn into somewhere where we deal with a bit of disappointment. And so here, the poem shifts. And so let me read you this here. Anon, permit the basest clouds to ride with ugly rack on his celestial face, and from the forlorn world his visage hide, stealing unseen to west with this disgrace. Now here, the poem shifts, and so the once majestic sun now, quote-unquote, permits base clouds to mar its face. And so the phrase ugly rack refers to ragged, ominous clouds, and the word celestial contrasts with ugly and basest. And so we see that the imagery moves from bright and sublime to dark and shamed. And the sun, that was once glorious, now hides from the world and retreats westward with disgrace. And so this personification, in a sense, hints at a betrayal or a fall from grace. And we could see that the speaker feels the loss deeply. And we also see that the world becomes forlorn. The sun's retreat feels like a personal slight or sorrow. And so we are turning into a bit of disappointment, sadness here. Lines 9 to 12. So now we are presented with a metaphor, a personalizing of the metaphor. And so the phrase my son will refer to a person, likely a beloved or a former lover, and whose presence once lit up the speaker's life. and the all-triumphant splendor that shown on the speaker's brow is deeply intimate. It's a deeply intimate image, which represents the warmth of love or admiration that was felt directly, almost as a divine gift. However, it was fleeting, but 1 hour mine, quote-unquote, that briefly sharpens the pain, and yeah, now the region cloud, which is likely a metaphor for some external circumstance in regards to betrayal or moral failure, has obscured this once glorious figure again. The final couplet, we get to a reflection. And so despite the hurt, we see that the speaker refuses to condemn the beloved in the phrase, "My love no whit disdaineth." And so there's a noble, almost stoic acceptance. And the final couplet delivers a significant thought. And so if the literal sun, the most constant divine force, if that could be blemished or obscured, then how can we expect perfection from mortals? Is the question that is conjured up with this final couplet. And quote-unquote, sons of the world, which implies humans, I believe, we see that they will naturally falter just as the heavenly sun does. So we see another comparison with the sun with humans. And so that was Sonnet 33. Now, before we move on to Sonnet 34, I have our last song to play today, which I also played in one of my previous episodes. It is called Constant Craving by K.D. Lang, and so we will give this one a listen to before we head back into Sonnet 34. We'll be right back after this.
The
That was Constant Craving by K.D. Lang, and we will get right into Sonnet 34. Why didst thou promise such a beauteous day, and make me travel forth without my cloak, to let base clouds overtake me in my way, hiding thy bravery in their rotten smoke? 'Tis not enough that through the cloud thou break, to dry the rain on my storm-beaten face, for no man well of such a self can speak, that heals the wound and cures not the disgrace, nor can thy shame give physique to my grief. Thou repent, yet I have still the loss, the offender's sorrow lends but weak relief. To him that bears the strong offense's cross, ah, but those tears are pearl which thy love sheds, and they are rich in ransom all ill deeds. And so this sonnet, the sun is again overtaken by clouds, but now the sun, which is also beloved, is accused of having betrayed the poet by promising what is not delivered. So again, we are encountering the other part that I mentioned before, where the beloved ultimately hurts the poet. And so the poet basically writes that while the beloved's repentance and shame do not rectify the damage done, the beloved's tears are so precious that they serve as atonement. So lines 1 and 4, these opening lines, they use an extended metaphor of weather to represent the emotional betrayal the poet's feeling. And so the speaker accuses the beloved of promising joy or constancy in the phrase beauteous day, which ultimately make the speaker feel safe and unguarded, quote-unquote, without my cloak. But then, unexpectedly, base clouds, the phrase base clouds, obscure the promised brightness. And so the quote-unquote rotten smoke implies not just obscurity, but corruption, something that's foul and disillusioning. The bravery here, I think, refers to the beloved splendor or beauty, which is now concealed. Moving on to lines 5 and 8. So here, the beloved's attempt at reconciliation is acknowledged, quote-unquote, through the cloud thou break. But the speaker will argue that it's insufficient. And so the image of, you know what, guys? In the middle of this, I'm hearing a bunch of thumping and loud noises. I don't know if you guys can hear, but it's kind of echoing through the studio, and I'm really curious to know what's going on, because it seems to me that the nest here is very quiet, but I do hear a lot of thumping, like it's some sort of club music. I'm just wondering what it is. Maybe I'll go check it out when I'm done the show today, but it's coming from outside. I can't really see, but if any of you guys do hear it, it's because there literally is thumping music that is going on outside of the studio. And the fact that it's echoing through the studio means it's pretty loud. And so just to clarify for those of you guys who do hear it, that's what it is. But yeah, moving on back to lines 5 and 8. And so the key idea here is that some injuries aren't just about pain, but about shame and disgrace. And so I think that's kind of the key thing to kind of take away from lines 5 to 8. So lines 9 to 12, the burden of hurt is here. So the lines here deepen the moral and emotional dynamic, where that the speaker acknowledges that the beloved's repentance, but the speaker also insists that it does not lessen the speaker's suffering. We could see that in the phrase, thy shame, and the repentance may be genuine, but they're not curative. And we also get a little taste of Christianity here. And so the Christian image of the cross is also very powerful, as it emphasizes that the speaker's suffering, it emphasizes that the speaker's suffering is not just burdensome, but redemptive in scale, which kind of likens to Christ's passion. The final couplet, we are getting into the volta, the turning point where the speaker's tone softens. And so the tears of the beloved, which is similar to pearls, which are rare, precious, and beautiful, have a redemptive quality. They ransom or redeem the wrongs committed. So it's a moment, it's an introduction to a kind of grace where emotional sincerity, which is embodied in the weeping we read, and it has the power to override intellectual objections or moral arguments. And so this shift, in a sense, suggests that while the speaker is intellectually understanding that the insufficiency of, like, so while the speaker understands the insufficiency of apology, they're still emotionally moved, or perhaps even undone, by the depth of the beloved's remorse. And so that was Sonnet 34. We'll move on to Sonnet 35. No more be grieved at that which thou hast done. Roses have thorns and silver fountains, mud, clouds and eclipses stain both moon and sun, and loathsome canter lives and sweetest bud. All men make faults, and even I in this, authorizing thy trespass with compare, myself corrupting, salving thy amiss, excusing thy sins more than thy sins are. For to thy sensual fault I bring incense, thy adverse party is thy advocate. And gainst myself a lawful plea commence, such civil war is in my love and hate, that I an accessory needs must be to that sweet thief which sourly robs from me. So that was Sonnet 35. And here the poet excuses the beloved by citing examples of other naturally beautiful objects associated with things hurtful or ugly. And then he goes on to accuse himself of being corrupted through excusing the beloved's faults. And so from lines 1 to 4, we are opened with an admonition, where it's stop grieving over what you've done. So immediately, the tone, in a sense, softens into a sort of philosophical consolation, and the lines present natural imagery that suggests the imperfection and how it's inherent even in beauty. We can see that with the phrases roses have thorns, where beauty and harm can coexist. Silver fountains have mud, where purity is not untouched by dirt. Celestial bodies are obscured, and that, in a sense, implies that even the most constant and heavenly things, like the moon and sun, can be stained. So each of these metaphors normalize, or try to at least normalize, fault and flaw. Lines 5 to 8, so then now here we can see that the speaker turns inward. So while previously he tried to comfort the beloved, now he is seen to reflect on his own moral compromise. And we can see that in the phrases, all men make faults, which kind of restates the universal nature of sin. And the phrase, even I in this. So this phrase will suggest that by forgiving or justifying the beloved's betrayal, the speaker is also at fault. Also the phrase is authorizing thy trespass with compare. This, in a sense, means that he gives permission for the sin by rationalizing it through the metaphor. The phrase myself corrupting reveals self-loathing, where the speaker tarnishes his own integrity by defending what should be condemned. And so that's significant in that sense. And so we could see that this formation of lines dramatizes the conflict between love and reason. So before, in the other lines 1 to 4, we see that it was trying to normalize fault and flaw, where in lines 5 and 8, we are seen to kind of dramatize the conflict between love and reason, or perhaps between moral clarity and emotional need. Moving on to lines 9 to 12, we are presented with some legal language and also one metaphor of internal conflict. We could see that in the phrase sensual fault, which refers to the beloved sexual transgression, which is likely seen to be infidelity. And the phrase I bring in sense suggests the speaker trying to rationalize the beloved's actions. The phrase thy adverse party is thy advocate. The speaker, who should be against the beloved, instead defends them. And this inversion of roles kind of shows how love distorts justice. We can kind of see that. And the phrase, gainst myself a lawful plea commence. This is also significant as he begins a legal case against himself in order to protect the beloved. And so we could see that the speaker is a judge, a jury, and also a defendant at the same time. So these lines, I believe that these lines evoke an idea of a civil war within the speaker, hence the internal conflict. The final couplet of Sonnet 35 is significant. It's very tight and it's emotionally complex, although it's only comprised of two. It's just a couplet. It's pretty significant in and of itself, where the poet becomes an accessory to a crime, complicit in his own emotional loss. And so the beloved is a sweet thief, someone who steals love or loyalty or happiness, but whom the speaker still finds endearing. And so in the phrase, sourly robs, the theft is painful, but the thief remains beloved. And so we can see that this couplet clinches or holds on to the emotional paradox, where he is wronged, but also enchanted at the same time. He's wounded, but still loving at the same time. And his forgiveness isn't pure. It's mixed up. It's entangled in guilt, desire, and shame. And so that is Sonnet 35 for you. And we have reached the end of the episode. We went through Sonnets 31 to 35 pretty intensely, I think. I think we did a pretty good analysis of the four poems. And so I'm pretty happy with that. But time to wrap it up. It's the end of the show. I hope you guys enjoyed it. It's pitch dark. I have no idea if it's raining or not. But I will go check out what the loud noise is coming from. I'm kind of looking forward to that. And if it's nothing, then I have no idea what it is. But we have come to the end. And so I hope you guys have a good rest of the evening, rest of the week, and I will be back again next Monday, so the 21st at 11 a.m. I have a fill-in show, and so for those of you guys who will join, I will see you guys on Monday again at 11 a.m. And so, yeah, that's the end of today's show. Have a great rest of the night, and I will see you guys again next week. Thank you all for joining. I'll see you later. Bye-bye.